We're holding at the top of design number Aleph.
Okay, so the Gemara had finished off yesterday mentioning that Rav had said the halacha is like what everybody else said is like Rav Meir, but really according to him is Chachamim, that in which end in connection with swearing about claims involving avodim and karkos, because in that sense an eved is like karka. So the Gemara asks, so mi omer Rav abdik karka yidami? Did Rav really say that an eved is considered like karka? If somebody grabs a hold of somebody else's eved, but also by malacha, and he uses the eved to do work, but he makes the eved do work for him, potter. Now, why should he be potter in that case?
If he's considered
like land, it should be considered mela. If he was considered metaltlin, then okay. As the Gemara is going to give us an example later involving a ship. Where a person steals a ship, he's not really stealing it per se as intending to keep it forever, he's just sort of borrowing it without permission. It's considered gezel. You know, you're not allowed to borrow something without permission, but it's not the same as stealing it permanently.
Even if he was
in the, in other words, the point is he'd have to pay something. If it's karka, then it's considered to be in the owner's original rishus. He should have to be paying rent for it, as if he was living in the guy's house or something. So what are you telling me, Potter?
But even if he's not karka, if he's considered metatl and he's using it, he should also be paying.
No, but that Tosfos mentions that there's a difference, because the difference is the Gemara is going to talk about later whether the metatlin that we're dealing with is something that is normally rented out or not. We're going to talk about it soon. Okay,
wait.
Shit.
You use someone else as a metatlin.
Wait. Well, we'll see later.
Okay.
We'll see later. In the example of the ship, that there is that distinction. We'll see that maybe there is a difference in karka as well. We actually had a difference about that earlier in the Masechta. I think I'm going to quote it again over here. The Tosfos HaShulchan has a long, detailed explanation about it. What the premise of the Gemara's question is. The Gemara doesn't know at this point that the owner stands to benefit from this guy using his eved. On the face of it, on the contrary, he's not benefiting from it. On the contrary, he's losing out. Now the eved has. The Gemara is going to distinguish in a minute whether the eved was supposed to be doing work at that time. If he was supposed to be doing work at that time, obviously the master was losing out. He didn't have him. He didn't have him available at that time. That's like Eliyahu asked the other day if he steals somebody's animal, and it turns out that that person was deprived of using it during that time. The Gemara is going to tell us in a minute that we're talking about a case where the eved was otherwise off work anyway. Nevertheless, at this point, the Gemara is assuming that the master is not losing anything, maybe, from his eved being used for work, but he's not gaining anything from it either.
He probably is losing something. I mean, the eved is becoming tired.
Wait. He's not doing work now anyway, so whatever. Anyway, the point is, therefore, that if we assume that the eved is like metaltlin, then fine, we can understand a svara to say that he's potter. Because again, if the master didn't lose anything from it, okay, he didn't gain anything either, maybe you don't have to pay him in a case like that.
But if it's a metaltlin, you wouldn't lose anything?
On the face of it, the Gemara is assuming at this point he hasn't necessarily lost anything by this eved doing work. Again, we're not necessarily talking about you had the eved do strenuous work that weakens him. We're talking about you had him, simple thing. You dictated a letter to him.
Because
if it was karka, the assumption is at this point, that even if the Gemara doesn't know yet something which we're going to discuss in a minute, that with karka, even if the guy is not losing out, if he's not gaining, then you still have to pay him. Okay, anyway. So the eved is still considered to be in his master's rishus all this time, exactly like karka. Karka can't really be stolen in that sense, so he should have to pay. The answer is we're talking about that you grabbed a hold of this eved and made him do work when he doesn't have other work to do. Rashi says either there's a certain schedule that he does work for his master and then now is outside of that schedule, or right now it happens that his master doesn't have any work for him to do. Therefore, in other words, it's one of those cases called Zenen Evzele Choser, which, as we learned earlier in the Masechta, even when it comes to karka, that concept does apply. As we find, we learned back in the second parak, that Rav Abba sent a message to Mori Bar Mar, who was one of the Talmidim of Rav Huna, Boi Minei Rav Huna, ask Rav Huna the following question: Hador b'chatzar chaveira shalom idaita. If somebody lives, if somebody dwells in somebody else's chatzar without his permission, so a squatter, does he need to pay him rent for that time or not? Rav Huna sent him back a message. He does not have to, because it's Zen Man of Azele Choser. Now, when we learned about this in the second parak, we learned that the situation was that this is a Choser where the guy would not ordinarily be renting out anyway. If it's something that he would ordinarily be renting out, obviously he's Choser. He could have been renting it out at the time, and instead you were squatting there. But because it's not something that he normally rents out, and therefore he's not losing anything from it. We learned also there was a distinction there. We said whether the person who squatted there, is he normally the kind of person who would otherwise have had to pay rent someplace else in order to stay or not. We discussed that consideration there.
No, but you can say the other way around. That, okay, usually the place is empty, it's not rented. The fact that there's someone who's there who could pay rent, he's a loss.
No, because again, if it's a place that he doesn't normally rent out anyway, then he's not losing anything because he wasn't going to rent it out anyway.
So the fact being that this guy stays there, it's a loss of income.
It can be. No, it's not a loss of income because there wouldn't have been any income. Now, we did discuss then that there could be a loss in a different sense if he ends up, for example, making the walls black, whatever, that was different. But we discussed that then. But if there isn't any of that, a chaser, for example, so there's no real damage to it by you squatting in it. And again, you're arguing there's a loss of income, but there really isn't, because he wasn't going to rent it out anyway. It wasn't something that was made to be that was originally designed to be rented out. We discussed then at the time the Business Halacha Institute has a similar discussion on their website as far as the case of taking somebody else's parking space. You know, it's a similar idea. I mean, if the guy is not using the space and it's not something he would normally be renting out anyway, then arguably it's the same kind
and
of thing.
I'm going to use someone else's office in Manhattan on Fifth Avenue that he's not using, and I'm going to say, okay, you know what? It's not used. I'm using it.
But you're likely to be. There's likely to be wear and tear on it. Besides which, also depends. I mean, many such offices that
may stay to wear and tear.
Yeah, you know, many such offices as you often have. If an office is, the company I work for used to have something like this, an office in Manhattan, which they rented basically on an as needed basis. If somebody needed it, then they had access to it, but then they'd be charged appropriately. So yeah, then it is definitely costly, because if you use it when it's not necessary, then they have to pay more rent. We're not talking about that. Anyway, so the point is over here, the same way, even if you argue that an Eved is like Karka, the same analogy applies. This Eved was not going to be doing any other work anyway, so it's Loi Choser, the master is not losing out from him being used. Your Nene, you're gaining, fine. It's Zen Nene, Zeloi Choser. Is fine. We learned then it's not necessarily fine as in the sense you can do it like a chila. We did say over there that the many Rishonim say it's not something you can do like a chila. It may be also to do, but if you did it, then you're not obligated to pay. Okay. We discussed then also, whether Tosfos discussed over there, is this the same as the issue, as this is the same thing as the concept of Kofin Amidat Sdoim or not? And actually, that's part of the distinction. Kofin Amidat Sdoim would be not only is the guy allowed to do it, but if the Balabas tries to prevent him and tells him you can't, we would tell the Balabas, sorry, you don't have the right to do that. It's Midas Sdoim to do that. Here it's the other way around. The Balabas does have the right to tell him no. If he tells him, he tells him, I know this place is available, I know you're looking for a place to sleep,
but I don't want,
then he has a valid claim. Then the guy's not allowed to.
But based on this Gemara...
Similar over here. If the owner of the Eved were to tell him ahead of time, I know that there's times when then it would be... In other words, the Zeh Chaser, to a certain extent, is a subjective thing. If I don't want you using my house or my Chaser or my Eved, then that becomes, in my point of view, that's a Chaser. Only if I didn't know about it, and then afterwards, after the fact, I find out that you've been squatting in that chatzar, using that eved, and I want to come and demand payment, then you have the ability to say, look, you didn't lose anything. I gained, you didn't lose anything. there's no reason I should always be saying it's a difference of Lachapchila versus Vidyavin, basically. Okay. Anyway, the point is, by analogy, the same thing. Gemara says, Hachi Hashter, how do you think to compare the two cases? I can understand it would work out well over there in the case of a house or a chater. It's not just, again, up until now, the Gemara started the sugya with the assumption that the owner of the Eved is losing out by having the other guy use his Eved. So we started by saying, okay, he's not losing out because the Eved was off work anyway. Right now, though, we're at the point, we're assuming he's not losing out, but he's not gaining anything either. Because with a house or a chater, as we learned when we learned the sugya of Zenan of Zelech Chater in the second paragraph, we said you are gaining because an uninhabited house tends to fall apart. Whether you look at it from the point of view of a house that's dwelled in tends to stay settled, tends to continue to exist because the person who lives there notices things that are breaking down and maintains it. So then nichale, so it helps him, it is good for him, and actually he gains from it. Bein lamanda omo ushiya yukashar, or what we said over there, based on a pasuk that the an uninhabited house gets attacked by shedim, the expression that Ma'abar Rav Ashi had said over there that he saw the house looked like it had been gored. So then also nichale, so also he gains.
Was that
Rappus? No, earlier on the second, in the second paragraph. So then also Michalei. So in other words, the two different ways of looking at it are you saying the house passively falls apart when nobody's in it, or are you saying it actively falls apart because shading destroys it? Whatever the case, either way, a person living there, not only the owner of it is not losing out, he's gaining from the fact that this person lives there. Here, would he want that his Eved becomes weaker? Okay, fine, the Eved was off work still. You know, which we may be talking about work that's strenuous. And yeah.
Provided he feeds him and gives him strength and everything he needs during the work.
Yeah. Amri, so the answer, Hochinami, Michalei, the Listere Abde. Yes, but in this case, actually, the master of this Eved does have a benefit. Not only he's not losing, but he actually gains from having his Eved used, the Listere Abde. That, you don't want his Eved to learn to be lazy, basically. He says he shouldn't learn the ways of being lazy. Like this, if he has too much time off, then he'll learn, you know, hey, it's good to slack off, you know, and then, yeah. Listen, Meloshin Soyser, like the destroying his work ethic, sort of. Yeah. In this connection, the Gemara tells another case. The family of Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama, which is the father of Rava, have a taktif avdi inchi. They would grab a hold of the avodim of people demasik buhuzuzi, where those people, the masters of those avodim, owed Rabbi Yosef or his family money, but avdi buhumalacha, and they would use them to do work. Omalei Rabba Brei, so Rabba, it says on the side here, really it should be Rava. His son, Rabbi Yosef Bachama's son was Rava, tells him, my time of Marachi, Rebbe, he calls his father Rebbe, and his father was one of the really Rebbeim. Why are you doing that? Amalei says, I'm allowed to. The Amar of Nachman, as we find that, Rav Nachman said, the famous Rav Nachman, Gemara had said on him yesterday that I and Shmuel are equals in Dinim Amunus, yeah? Rav Nachman had said, Avda Nahum Kreise Lo Shavi, an Eved is not even worth the bread for his stomach. Meaning, in other words, again, it's another way of saying, in other words, the masters of these Avodim are not really losing anything. It's not like we're talking about a valuable asset that they're losing out if I use it temporarily. Amalei, so Rava tells him, Eima Domer of Nachman, you got to say what case Rav Nachman is talking about. Daru Avde, he's talking about, for example, his own, he's talking from his own experience, his own servant Daru, the Malkid Bekuvi. This Daru used to dance around in taverns. We learned earlier in the Masechta when we dealt with the case of a person whose hair is permanently removed, that now he can't do that. He can't dance in taverns anymore and earn drinks that way. This Daru used to do that. Rahman couldn't get a decent day's work out of him. Cooler Abdi Mavid Abdi, but most of them work hard. How can you say your average Eved is not even worth the amount for bread for their stomach? Amalei, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama answers him, I'm not good of Daniel, speedily. Fine, but I hold like what Rabbi Daniel said at the top of our Amud, at the beginning of our discussion. We just went through that. If somebody uses somebody else's eved and took, if he grabbed the hold of him, and he has him do malacha for him, he's potter. Which we just established. The reason why that is because the owner is actually benefiting that his eved is not off work too much and therefore learns to slack off. So therefore, on the contrary, I'm benefiting them. Amalei, so Rava tells him, yes, but there is one little detail over here. Hanimili, hechad lemasik b'huzuzi. All of that works very well if those people don't owe you money. Mar, but you, Rebbe, given the masik b'huzuzi, since you have a debt, and since you owe, masik b'huzuzi literally means that you're demanding money. Not really demanding. Masik b'huzuzi means that you are in possession of a loan that they owe you zuzim, that they owe you money. You're their creditor. In that case, you have a different issue. Mechzik ribis, you using the avodim. Once we established that your avod, now if we say that your average avod is worthless, like Reb Nachman's avod, fine, then it can't really be called ribis. Once we established that your average avod is a valuable asset, then to use it, even if you're arguing that they have a certain benefit from it, it seems like mechzik ribis. It may not be true ribis, but it seems like ribis.
In other words, they owe you money.
They owe you money, and now you're using their avod. It's sort of like ribis, yeah. Because what is ribis? I mean, the ribis d'oraisa is that to begin with, at the time of the loan, you know, you say, you know, I'm going to pay you extra. Yeah, but there's all kinds of ribis d'rabbanan. Ribis d'rabbanan in general includes when, in all kinds of cases, we'll learn many details of them in Bava Metzia, in a few months' time, Be'ez Hashem. And actually, this whole sugya is right there in Ezer Neshach as well, in connection with the dinim of ribis. But basically, when the creditor, the malva, is getting something more than he gave the lawyer in the first place. In this case, he is. He's getting work out of an eved.
So that's with the consent of the malva.
It doesn't matter. Ribis, classic ribis d'oraisa can also be with the consent of the lawyer. It doesn't matter, though. The point is, whether it's with or without consent, ribis is also. Again, d'oraisa is only ribis tzutza, where it was made up at the time of the loan that there's going to be X amount, you know, X number of dollars or X percentage or whatever paid extra. Midrabbanan is all kinds of other cases where there ends up being definitely or at least a very high likelihood that the malva is going to get more than he left the guy. D'amr of Yosef Aman Yumi Amr of Nachman, as in fact we find that Rabbi Yosef Aman Yumi said in the name of Rabbi Nachman, Afisha Omru Adur Bahasaf Havedishalemidaita and Sarah Bahalas Beskar, even though it is true that we said before that if you live in somebody else's kotzer without their knowledge, you don't have to pay them, because as we said, then it was Ele Kotzer. Hilvahu Adur Bahasaf Havedah. However, if he lent him money and now he wants to live in the other guy's kotzer for free, Sarah Bahalas Beskar, then he does have to pay him, because otherwise you have a problem with ribbons. Tosfos points out, by the way, usually we say that the loiver is not allowed to do anything extra for the malva that he wouldn't have been doing before. For example, you know, there's a famous thing that comes from that after the loan. So, for example, there's the famous thing that we all know that you're not supposed to say thank you to somebody for a loan because it would be a form of ribbis dvarim. There's also, for example, the Mishnah mentions over there at the end of Ezer Neshech that, let's say, for example, if the loiver now wants to make a practice of going and then greeting the malva every morning, where up until now he didn't, that would also be ribbis dvarim. On the other hand, if all this time he always was doing that, then it's not a problem to continue. If he always said Shalom Aleichem to him every morning, he can continue saying Shalom. So what's the difference over here? Let's say, for example, this malva all along was living in the chotzer of wheat. Why all of a sudden is it a problem of ribbis? Tosfos distinguishes that first of all says there may be a difference between something public or not. It's true. If it was something, for example, that he always said hello to him before, or they were regularly borrowing items from each other, their clothes, horses, whatever, then fine, they can continue doing that afterwards and not have a problem with ribbis. But something public like this, living in this kotzer, you know, everybody knows this is Pliny's kotzer, and you're living in it, that could be an issue. And then Tosfos makes another distinction that maybe it is actually a difference. Maybe indeed, if beforehand they would regularly let each other live in their chaser rent free for a while, squat there for a while and be there rent free, maybe they are allowed to continue it afterwards. Here we're talking about where they weren't. Okay. Anyway. So therefore, again, even if you're going to argue that taking their evet and using it helps them, and therefore it shouldn't be a case where you have to pay them, fine, it helps them in the same sense as living in the person's chaser, but you still have the ribbis issue. The fact that you're getting a place to live for free, the fact that you're getting work out of an evet for free. Amalei, so Rabbi Yisbach HaMatol, and Hadribi, you're right. I go back on it. I change my mind. You're right. From now on, I won't do this anymore.
So it is at least a form of it, at least it seems.
Robert didn't say it is ribbis. It seems like ribbis, at least. Yeah. So now a related concept. If somebody grabs a hold of somebody else's ship and uses it to do work, so now, when the owner gets back the ship, and again, you're not considered, the guy didn't literally go take the ship intending to keep it permanently. He was kind of using it without permission. You're not allowed to do that, but it's not the same. It is a form of, it's related to Gezel. You're certainly not allowed to do it. But you can't consider him a full-fledged Gazlan. You can't consider him a full-fledged Gazlan, as the Gemara itself is going to say in a minute. Now, when a person has used the ship, when you think about it, there's two possibilities. There's the usual amount that would be that the usual rental fee for this kind of boat, and number two, there's the depreciation. Every time a boat is used, it depreciates a little bit. So, if the owner has his choice now, if he wants, he can bill the guy as if he had rented it and charge him at the usual rate for rental, or if he wants, he can charge him for the depreciation. Pasa means the depreciation. Or Shmuel, ain't a note to pasa. Shmuel says no. All he's entitled to is the amount for the depreciation. I'm going to pop a light plea. They're actually, Rav and Shmuel are not really arguing. And this is what I was. And this is now going to be the point that I was mentioning when we first started the discussion. Ha David la Agra. One is talking about where the ship is normally made to be rented. So then we can assume that when this person took the ship, we shouldn't consider him really a gazlan. We should consider him sort of a renter without having signed the paperwork or whatever.
That's for the ship that's usually rented.
Yeah, for something that's usually rented. Therefore, the owner has the option to charge him at the normal rental rate, which usually is higher. As opposed to if the ship is not normally rented out, so then you can't charge him for a rental fee because that's something he would have normally rented anyway. We charge him the depreciation.
But more than a guy who's renting the boat.
No, it would be less. Typically depreciation would be less. And when you think about it, when you rent anything, usually, you know, the rental fee includes the depreciation, but it includes, you know, includes other factors as well. The Ibaisema, or another possibility, both cases could be talking about where this is the ship that normally would be rented out. So Rav, we can understand, he has the ability to charge him rent, or he can charge him the depreciation, which is less. Why, according to Shmuel, is he only entitled to the depreciation? Because one of them, Rav, can be talking about where the person who went and took this ship is doing it, thinking of it as something to be rented. So therefore, make him pay the rental.
The one who takes the ship.
The other is Shmuel's point of view is when he's going into the ship, having in mind to steal it. Therefore, the usual rule applies. Kol gazlan and mishalem and kashat gzela, as we said in the Mishnah, the gazlan pays according to the value at the time of the gzela. So therefore, you make him pay the depreciation. Because at the time of the gzela, it was worth 1,000. Now after he used it, it's worth 950. Fine. So he returns the ship and he owes $50. There wasn't enough machinery to make it be considered that would be coming to the ship. But so therefore he owes $50. But you can't make him pay $100, let's say, which would be 50 for the depreciation plus another 50, which goes into the normal rental fee, because he didn't do it as a renter, he did it as a goblin. Next, the Mishnah said, Gozel Matbeah Benista Kola. The Mishnah had mentioned a couple of cases. A person stole a coin, and then before he returned it, it cracked, where now it's not usable anymore. Or we said he stole potatoes that rotted, or wine that went sour. In all those cases, we said, Mishalim Kshatak Zela. That he pays the full value of it as it was worth when he stole it. As opposed to, then the mission had continued, if he stole a coin and it was nifsal, it was withdrawn from circulation, it was announced that this coin is no longer legal tender. You can imagine, we're not familiar with it, because in the United States they've used the same coinage for 200 years, but think of in Europe, for example, a few years ago when they changed it over to the euro, where now, and after a certain period of time, all the francs and marks and then pounds and whatnot are all... Not pounds. Yeah, you're right. I forgot about that. Yeah, whatever. Okay, all the national
certain tokens that have value.
That's it. Okay, that would be. Another example. Yeah. Okay. You're right.
I remember going to the store and someone ran out of money. He paid with a token.
Okay.
And he still accepted it.
But another example. Well, I mean, the Gemara itself is going to distinguish over here two different kinds of nifsal. But just I'll mention also. Another kind of thing. You could imagine. Think of, for example, when the regime changes. I imagine, for example, when the communists took over in Russia, I doubt that coins with the Tsar's picture on it were legal tender anymore. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, the Mishnah had said that in those cases, if the coin was nifsal, it was withdrawn from circulation, or truma that became tamei, or chametz and pesach fast, or whatever, then we said, then he just says, hadei shalach panecha, here's your thing. I stole a coin, here's the coin. The coin is not legal tender anymore, not my problem. So, Amar Rav Huna, nistek means nistek mamash. The word cracked in the Mishnah means literally it got cracked. Okay, so it's no longer usable. Nifsal means salatu mamash. And the word nifsal means that the government withdrew it from circulation. The king announced, Rashi said, that this coin is no longer to be used in this country or in any other country.
It's out.
Now, in theory, it could be used in foreign countries, maybe, but it wouldn't really be legal tender there either. It belongs to the king of this country. Whatever. It's not usable as currency anywhere in this particular king's kingdom. Rav Yehuda says no. Salatim malchus nami hainanis. No, if the king announced that it's no longer usable as a coin, effectively that's the same thing as it being cracked. It's a goner. It's not usable anymore. Ela hechidami nifsal. So what does it mean nifsal in our Mishnah? Shab salatim medina zu v'yotzim medina acher. It means one particular country in the kingdom decided that it's possible for them. They don't want to use it. But in other countries, it's still acceptable. I'll tell you, actually, I used to, when I was a kid 25 years ago, I used to be into coin collecting for a while. I can tell you an example. There was at one point in the 1700s, the British king, they ruled over Ireland, over most of Ireland as well. They needed some coins minted for that area. They contracted with a guy who's entitled to mint coins for them, and he has to pay X amount to the treasury, and he can keep the rest for himself. For some reason or other, these coins were extremely unpopular with the Irish. Jonathan Swift wrote a whole satire against it. Whatever, nobody in Ireland. They finally shipped them over to America because they figured the Americans will take anything. So I used to. It was made out of copper. There were half pennies and then quarter pennies. But anyway, there was an example of Salat of Virginia. In theory, I suppose, these coins were usable in America, which was also ruled over by Great Britain at the time, but they weren't usable in Ireland. That's Salat of Virginia. So, therefore, so because they're still usable, so therefore, so it's usable... That's what we're going to talk about on Omid Beis. That's a different matter. That's one kingdom, one regime being replaced with another. Here we're talking about the Irish still stayed under British rule. All it is they weren't going to use these. They demanded them. the point is, in other words, if it's salata medina zuv yotzim of din acheres, then you're able to tell him hareshalachofanecha. I can't use this coin in Ireland. Not my problem. Take it to America. It'll be worth the full. It'll be worth the full amount there. Okay, if you're going to say, Rakuna, that the word nifsal means that the government announced that this coin is not legal tender anywhere in the kingdom, then you've got to ask, isn't the next cases in the Mishnah like fruit that went that spoiled or wine that went sour or whatever, isn't that exactly the same kind of thing? In all cases, it's not usable as coin, it's not usable as fruit, etc. And the Mishnah clearly said that in that case you have to pay according to the original value. But why are you saying that the difference between, that there's a difference between nisdak, where the coin is physically no longer usable, and nifsal, where it's not usable because of the king's orders? Either way, it's completely not usable. Why should it be any different than fruit that rotted?
True.
Amalei, so the opponent tells him, "Hasan mishtana time of erech." The difference is, in the case of the fruit or the wine, the taste changed, the smell changed. Hachalei mishtana. Here, there's no actual physical change to the coin. Yeah. So therefore, there's reason to argue that it's different. So then that's the thing. So that's according to Rav Huna, there's a difference there. If the coin was actually physically damaged, then you have to pay Keshat Zegzel. Then you have to pay Keshat Zegzel, pay him the full value. But if it was just not, if it wasn't physically damaged, but it was withdrawn from circulation, it belonged to the previous king, and the current king doesn't want to use it anymore. Not my problem. Amalei Rava or Rabbi Yehuda, Rabba, it says on the side over here, Rava or Rabba asks Rabbi Yehuda, Lididach, fine, let's ask the other way around. Lididach, Amit Salatu Malchus Nami Hainu Nistek. What about, according to you, you're arguing that if the coin was disqualified by the king, then that's the equivalent of it being cracked, and therefore you have to pay the full value of it because it's no longer usable. Had a Truma of a Nitmet. What about the next case in the Mishnah, the next group of cases in the Mishnah included Truma that became Tomei, Salatu Malchus Tomei. Again, that's the equivalent of the king declaring it possible, because it's possible. It's no longer usable for food. And the Gemara could have answered that we're talking about, let's say, truma that could be used as firewood or something. At least it has some limited value, but not necessarily, because it could be talking. What about, for example, if it was truma of strawberries or something? You can't even use those. You can't use them once they're truma. You can't use them for anything. And yet the Mishnah says that you're able to say Hare Shalach Panecha, that it's not my problem, they became Tomei. The Hare Shalach Panecha literally means he used yours in front of you. In other words, fine, I stole this Truma from you, here's the same Truma. I has a different status because before it was Tohar, now it's Tomei. Not my problem. Amalei, so Rabbi Yehuda tells him the difference is Hasam Le Minker Hazeka. Yes, but the difference is that in the case of Truma that became Tomei, there is no visible difference between it and any other wheat or grain or what have you.
Minkar?
Minkar means recognizable. Hacha Minkar Hazeka. Over here, there is a certain recognizable difference. Namely, how is it recognizable? Because you know what the current circulating coins look like, and this one is the odd one out. This one has a picture of the previous king on it, or it has whatever, it's obviously different than the current circulating coin. So in other words, it comes out then that what we're saying is, according to Rav Huna, we have the distinctions as follows. You have where the thing is physically damaged, versus where it's not physically damaged. That's the key thing. So in the case of a coin, physically damaged means that it's cracked. Not physically damaged means that it's been disqualified by the government. It looks different than all the other coins out there. That's not considered to be a difference. And according to Rabbi Yehuda, the other way around. The difference is you look at, is there any kind of physical distinction between this and anything else? The coin looks different than all the others, let alone the coin is cracked, where everybody would agree that's the case, versus where there's no noticeable physical difference at all, namely Truma that became Tomei. Okay, it's right. So now that we have a discussion of Amoroyim that goes as follows. If somebody lends somebody else goods, any kind of goods, for money, so Rashi says, they agreed on a certain price. They agreed on a certain number of coins will be paid for this merchandise. So basically what he's doing is he's selling them on credit. the Nifsala Mateya. Now, later on, that type of coin was disqualified, was withdrawn from circulation. Rava Manosan Lemateya Yotabosha. So Rav says in that case you have to give him the kind you have to give him the kind of coins that are circulating at the time.
At the time
when you pay back, in other words. You said you're gonna give him 10 queens. You said you're gonna give him $10, let's say. Well, now the old kind of dollar coins have been withdrawn from circulation. So now you've got to give him 10 of the new dollar coins.
And if they contain more gold, then more.
There's more gold or more silver. That Gemara is going to talk about at the end of the Amud. We may get to it today. We may not. We'll see. Rashi points out the difference is if he lent him coins, then there's no question. He has to, in order to avoid issues of ribis, he would have to. Well, actually, we're going to talk about that later. Rashi just says Abu Havol Mois Esher Havol Mashalim. Like whatever he lent him is what he has to pay back. The point is, we're discussing over here, does he have to pay him back the same number of coins, just in the new currency, or Shmuel Omar, whereas Shmuel says, no, Yoholoi Malai, the one who is paying the money, the one who received the goods on credit, can say, Leichetziyeh b'mishan, go spend this coin in Mishan. Mishan, we learned back at the end of Kiddushin, is an area in southern Babel nowadays, kind of on the border between Iraq and Iran. It was a different division. It was in some more or less like nowadays Kuwait, I guess, whatever. Anyway, there was a different area in the empire, in the kingdom. Coins that are not usable in Babel might be usable there.
Go live where it's usable.
Not live necessarily, but go spend it over there. In other words, it still has a certain validity. In Mishan, they'll take it. So in that case, I'm entitled to pay you in these old withdrawn coins. You're not going to find anybody here who takes them. Fine, you'll find people there who'll take them.
Who's paying the trip?
Wait, Amar of Nachman, Mistabra Milsid Shmuel the Islet Urchal Mizalameshan. It makes sense what Shmuel is saying if he has a way to go to Mishan. When we say a way to go to Mishan, Rashi learns that it means that he's going to be going to Mishan anyway. He's going to be going to Mishan anyway, so therefore you might as well take this along with it. But if he's not, then not. The Rashba learns differently. The Rashba says that it literally means if he's able to go to Mishan, as opposed to, in other words, suppose that there's a war going on and he's not able to get through to Mishan. That's different. But as long as he's able to go,
means there's no war,
the roads are open, then he can say, you go to Mishan. The money is able to be spent over there. You don't want to make the trip. Not my problem.
And he's physically not able to go there.
Physically not able, maybe the Rashba would include that as well. I don't know. But when you say physically not able, do you mean, let's say, like he's handicapped or whatever?
Yeah,
maybe that's I don't know. Maybe I don't know. I don't know what the Rashba would say about that. I guess the same thing. I mean, if he can't go there, he can't go there. It's still there. Okay. But if he doesn't have a way to get there, meaning again, according to Rashi, that he doesn't have any particular need to go to Mishan anyway, or according to the Rashi, he has no way of getting there for one reason or another. Then you can't say that Shmuel would say the money is available to spend in Mishan because it's not. I'm here and you're there. I'm here. Mishan is there, and never the twain shall meet. So, Rava in turn asks. Of Nachman, you're telling me you want to make that distinction according to Shmuel, whether you're able to or want to, whatever, get to Mishan or not. But we have a Braisa that says as follows. Now we know, and we've learned many times, that Maisa Sheni is supposed to be redeemed for cash if you can't take the fruit itself to your shalim. It was in last week's parasha too, actually. You're not allowed to redeem. You're not allowed to transfer the kedusha of Maisa Sheni fruit onto coins. If those coins don't circulate, Rashi says specifically klal b'Yerushalayim. If they don't circulate at all in Yerushalayim, because the pasuk tells us the pasuk used the expression that you exchange it for kesef, v'tzarta kesef b'yotcha. Now kesef has a double meaning in Hebrew. It means silver and it means money. A number of other languages, but that's true also, by the way. The same word for silver is used to mean money. When we learn Bava Metzia, when we learn the beginning of Perek HaZahav, we'll see the significance of that. The Gemara was going to point out over there that silver coins circulate more readily than gold and also more readily than copper. silver is kind of the default metal for coinage. You could understand it and to mean that you transfer the kedusha of the coins onto silver and you take the silver to your shlayim. However, because you have the word v'tzarta kesef, the symbol meaning of it, it means you should tie it up in a bundle, meloshen tsur. But the Gemara in a bunch of places also explains, also darshins, that the tzarta is meloshen tsura, of a figure, a stamp. So it means it has to be stamped metal, coins, in other words, not just blank pieces of metal. So if these coins won't circulate, they can't be considered coins. The whole point of a coin is that it's something that circulates, something that people will accept for its face value. If they won't, then legal tender, in other words, So therefore, you can't be machalo on money, on coins that are not yotzeis, that don't circulate. Kesad. Hole mois kozvius yerushalmius. Suppose somebody has money kozvius or kozvius from Yerushalayim. Rashi has two explanations of kozvius means. So Rashi gives two explanations of kozvius means. One is it means from Ben Kuziva, the famous character known to history as Bar Kochba. He ruled for a period of time. We learned in Gittin that he ruled for 2.5 years. And then later on he was in Beit Zer, etc. So during that time he issued coinage. They found some of those coins. Nowadays they found them hoards all over Eretz Yisrael. But in later times, obviously, they don't circulate anymore. Ben Kuziva died, killed in battle, whatever. His whole thing fell apart, and then the coins no longer circulate. So they're called Kozvius Yerushalmius, as in they're minted by Ben Kuziva when he ruled in Yerushalayim. Then Rashi has the second explanation that it means that Kozvius or Yerushalmius. Kozvius means from the city of Kuziv, a city in Eretz Yisrael, or Yerushalmius or from Yerushalayim. That's what you were mentioning when we were talking before on Amud Aleph, let's say, for example, when the Romans conquered Eretz Yisrael. This is what we're talking about. These were talking about coins that had been minted by one of the Jewish rulers in Eretz Yisrael, such as Ben Kuziva or the Hashmonaim or what have you. And now, once the Romans came along, then they're disqualified as legal tender anymore, Or you have coins from the earlier kings, which are not legal tender anymore. And then you're not allowed to be mechala. My tasheni on those,
but implying
harshalach roinim dumya dirishayin mechalin. But it sounds like, in other words, if you have coins from the later kings, from the current kings, which are similar to the rishayim in the sense that you can't spend them here, they're not legal tender here, but they're legal tender someplace else in the kingdom. For example, in Mishan, then mechalin. Then you're allowed to be mechala on them. So therefore, in other words, so what are you telling me, Rav Nachman? This is what Rava is asking Rav Nachman. You're telling me that we should make a distinction according to Shmuel, whether you're able to get to Mishan or want to get to Mishan, whatever, or not. From the Braisa, it seems there's no such distinction. As long as the coins can be spent in Mishan, or actually in Yerushalayim, really, because that's relevant for our purposes, whatever, the principle is still the same thing. As long as the money is able to be spent in Yerushalayim, as long as it has value in Yerushalayim, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't seem to matter whether you're actually able to take the coins there or not. Or whether you want to, or whether you have occasion to go there or not. Yeah? Yes, but you know what we're talking about? In this Braisa, we're talking about when these various kingdoms, let's say we're talking about sub-kingdoms within Eretz Yisrael. You have, let's say, and there were in different times. You had, for example, there were periods of time when there was one king in the Galil and another one in Yehuda and whatever. So, but let's say, for example, that they don't object. They don't object one to another. If you want to take the coins from the Galil and spend them in Yerushalayim, the rulers in Yerushalayim aren't going to object. So therefore, fine. Then the coins are not legal tender in the sense that you can't force somebody in Yerushalayim to accept them, but they are spendable over there. Okay, then the question is, Elakiyama Shmuel Kshmachis Makfidus Zu'al Zu. Fine, so what are you telling me? Then Shmuel is talking about a case when the two kingdoms, let's say in Bavel and Mishan, do object to each other. They're at a state of war. In Mishan, they're not going to allow you to spend coins from Bavel and vice versa. Well, then, Hechi Mati Mamtila, who are you going to get them in there in the first place? They contraband. They'll search your luggage. They'll find that you have coins from the other kingdom over there, and you'll be in trouble. The answer is, the Mamtila Ayat Chak. The case is, we can be talking about where you're able to bring them in with difficulty. Namely, Deloitte Bakshi, they don't normally search your luggage. But if they find that you're carrying such coins, kafi, then they'll object. They'll think that you're loyal to the other king and not to them, and you'll get in trouble. So in other words, there's three possibilities. There can be where the two kingdoms are at peace and coins will freely circulate from one to the other. Let's say, like the United States and Canada, let's say. You can have where they're at war, but they're not going to search your luggage for them. And then we're going to have the other case, as we're going to talk about soon, where they will actually search your luggage. They literally cannot be brought from point A to point B because they're across the border, because they will search your luggage. And you'll be arrested.
And
we're going to say soon, right? So far, all we have is the first two. Where they're at peace, then for sure you're allowed to use such coins to redeem my Sheni. Even though they're not normally spent in your Shalayim, because normally you have that they could be. And number two, where you will be able to sneak them across the border.
The Gabayim used to accept these foreign coins.
We're not talking about for Max the Shekel. For Max the Shekel, yeah, I mean, if you brought foreign coins, that's why they have money changers over there to exchange them. But we're talking about over here for Maitre Sheni. It's not, it's a personal, it's a private thing. The Gaboyim, the Gizborim, or whatever aren't involved. You redeem the Maitre Sheni on coins. You bring the money to your Shalayim, or you send it with somebody else, or whatever. You spend that money in your Shalayim on food, and you eat it.
But the
Gizborim have nothing to do with it.
No, I know, but when you wanted to exchange, let's say, Shumas Meister or something.
Shumas Meister, again, the Gizborim aren't involved. If you're talking about Hekdesh, for example, it's a Hekdesh. You have the actual goods. I mean, what you're going to pay Hekdesh with, I don't know if they'd only accept local coinage or not. I don't know. Toshma. Another Bryce says, "Ein mechalin al moris chokan behen bebavo." You cannot be mechalo maitasheni on money on coins of hiu, meaning your shalayim, where the coins themselves are in bubble. So these are coins that were issued in your shalayim. There's coins that were issued in your shalayim, but they happen to right now be in bubble. And Rashi explains that the owner himself is in bubble also with the coins. I'm mechalal. I'm always shokan behind the bubble. You cannot be mechalal on money from here, which is now in bubble. Shok bubble behind kan, or money that was minted in bubble and is now present in your shalayim. But shabava v'hein b'bava mechalin. But if it was money that was minted in bubble and is now located in bubble, and the owner himself is there also, because you have to be where the coins are, mechalin. That you can be mechalin.
Isn't that obvious?
Why is it obvious? Why should he be? So that's what we have to figure out. Katanimi ein mechalin on moiz shokan v'hein b'bava. What do we say, man? We said that you can't be mechalin on money that was minted here in Eretz Yisrael, where that money is right now present in bubble. Now, even though, what are we talking about? That money is going to end up being brought to your shalayim, because that's what you do with Maitre Sheni money. So what's the problem? If it was minted in your shalayim, and if it went to bubble, but eventually it's going to return to your shalayim, why shouldn't you be able to use it to redeem it? You can't redeem Maitre Sheni in your shalayim anyway. Why shouldn't you be able to redeem it? You are standing in bubble with this pile of coins that were minted in Eretz Yisrael. Why can't you redeem your Maitre Sheni on it, and then you'll bring it, and then you'll bring those coins to your shalayim? And here comes Here we're talking about where the two countries are mocked on each other. They're in a state of war.
And they're going to check.
And that's the question. And they're going to check. They're going to check. So therefore, in other words, apparently it seems from Rashi that it may not just be a matter of that they'll check. They'll check your luggage. It may even be they'll do house-to-house searches. See, it sounds like from Rashi. Yeah.
What do you expect the people to do with the coins? It's their money. They earned it.
They'll confiscate them.
No, you brought it from an enemy country. You're trading with the enemy. You know, yeah. I don't know.
You go with the coins.
Okay, so then the question is, fine. then what is the Braita saying? That if you're in Bavel and the coins themselves were minted in Bavel, you're allowed to use them to redeem Maitre Sheni. What are you going to do with them then? You can't. If we're talking about the two kingdoms are at war, you're not going to be able to bring the stash of Bavel coins to Israel. The two kingdoms are at war. You'll be searched at the border. So what good does it do to be mechalal on such coins? That's the question. The answer is chazu de zavin bo behemu mask for shalayim. Yes, but what you're able to do with such coins then in Bavel, you're able to spend them on an animal there in Bavel and take the animal with you across the border to Israel. That you'll be able to do. Yeah.
Okay, the question is, V'hatanya hiskinu shiru ha'moris yotin b'yushalayim v'netach. We have another braisa that says that they made a takana, that they made a takana that the coins should be, that the coins should be ones that are able to be spent in Yerushalayim because of this, because of these kinds of problems of cross border things. So how can you use money of Bavel that was minted in Bavel that is, in other words, we're talking about that you have to be able to use coins that are, going to be spendable in Yerushalayim. So it sounds like you're bringing actual coins. So, rather, the question Rashi, says is that you're saying you cannot use money of Bavel, which is located here in Yerushalayim. Well, why not? So, Amar Rav Zeira, like Kasha, can bisman shiyad Yisrael takifa lo masalem? No, the difference is like this. One case is talking about when the Jewish people have power over the nations of the world. Not that we don't just mean, in other words, the kind of power like from the time of David and Shlomo. We mean, in other words, that there's a Jewish sovereign government in Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, and therefore they have their choices, they're able to declare what's legal tender here or what's not.
Shiyad Yisrael,
the Kipalu Masarla. That Jewish people have power over the nation.
When did that ever happen?
For example, I'm saying it didn't happen. When I say powerful over the nation, it doesn't mean it has to be like Shlomo Amalek that rules over all the nations in the world. It just means that there's a sovereign government in Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim that it doesn't matter whether it's respected abroad. The point is that they have power over any of the local goyim. They have the ability locally to set what is legal tender and what is not. The other case is talking about when the goyim have power over themselves, or really actually that's a euphemism, it really means that the goyim have power over us, Jewish people, where then it's not up to Jews to determine what's legal tender and what's not. So that's the difference. In other words, if Jews have power, then they're able to declare what's legal tender in Yerushalayim. So then fine, you can use money from Bavel that was minted in Bavel in Eretz Yisrael, because fine, the Jewish authorities can decide we're willing to accept it. But when the goyim are in power, the Jews don't have the ability to set that agenda, and therefore, yeah. Okay. Since we're mentioning money of Yerushalayim, we mentioned earlier on the Amud money of Yerushalayim, so the Gemara digresses a little bit to a shtickle agadah. Tana Rabbanan, Ezeu Matbea Shel Yerushalayim, what is the coinage of Yerushalayim, the original coinage of Yerushalayim? David and Shlomo mitzad echad, the Yerushalayim Yerakadish mitzad echad. On one side it had David and Shlomo. Rashi says that just mean it said the word David and Shlomo, not that it had a picture. What? They've never found them. Okay, so they haven't found lots of things. So David and Shlomo on one side, and the city of Yerushalayim on the other side. The point is, now, Rashi is implying they couldn't put pictures of David and Shlomo because you're not allowed to make images, not on coins or whatever. It said the word David and Shlomo. On the other side, it said Yerushalayim.
Oh, yeah. Not even a picture of Yerushalayim.
It could have, I guess, but the point is that one of the parshim, and Yaakov points out that evidently what forces Rashi to say that it said Yerushalayim is because the Gemara is juxtaposing him. The Gemara is mentioning them in the same breath. So if it had to say David and Shlomo and he couldn't have images of them, then Pasha doesn't mean just said Yerushalayim without having a picture of it. The Ezer Matbea Shel Avraham Avinu, and by the way, what is the coinage of Avraham Avinu? Now, how do we know Avraham Avinu even had coinage? So Tosfos brings from a medrash from Bereishis Rabbah that when the Eibusha tells him, "Vagadlo Shmecha, I will make your name great," that includes Shiyotle Munitin Ba'olam. Now, Munitin means coins. It's related to the word monetary and all those words. It means he became famous in the world with his coinage. So what was that coinage? Zokin Ruskein Mitzad Echad, Ubachar Basula Mitzad Echad. An old man and an old woman on one side, a young man and a young woman on the other side. Rashi learns that it means, so you had Avraham and Sarah, or their names at least, on one side, and Yitzchak and Rivka on the other. To represent the idea that even Avraham and Sarah were old, and by nature they couldn't have had children anymore, nevertheless they had a child, Yitzchak, and he even was strong enough, he grew up to marry Rivka. Maharsha learns differently. Maharsha learns that it's actually the old man and the old woman on one side, of course, represent Avraham and Sarah. The young man and woman on the other side represent also Avraham and Sarah. The Eivishta made them young again. Sarah, we know in the pasuk that the Eivishta made her young again to be able to have a child. And although the Medrash says that also Avraham Avinu was also made to be young. So therefore, this was a way of publicizing the nest to the whole world that the Eivishta had made them youthful again and able to have children. Ben Yoyada says a vote on it, by the way, that another deeper meaning of it was that they wanted to teach the world, you know, in much of the world, the attraction between a husband and a wife is based on their physical looks. So eventually, you know, you get old and, you're tired of each other, you know, and then you go and get a young trophy wife or whatever, you know. They wanted to show that, no, that's not how a relationship of the proper kind should be. We value each other for our midas tovus, for all our, and those keep on improving with age. Therefore, even when we're zaken and skene, even when we're old people, we still feel towards each other like bachur and besula, like a young man and a young woman, because our appreciation and our love for each other is fresh. It is fresh and constant because we keep on seeing new great milas in each other. Yeah.